Good afternoon, everybody. I'm not sure if it's appropriate, but I probably should say, may it please the court. And I want to blame somebody right at the outset for my involvement in the Federalist Society, and that's Judge Tom Barber, who got me involved way back in 2000 when he and I were members at the same time of Carlton Fields in its Tampa office. Yes, I served as one of the deputy independent counsels during the Whitewater investigation, and it was a wonderful time, and we're here to share that with you today. It's finally appeared in book form through Ken Starr's book, Contempt. And by the way, it's important to note that when we finish today around 2 p.m., Ken will be signing books again, and we're hoping that you'll take advantage of that opportunity. So who is this legal giant that we have over here to my left? It's Ken Starr, former member of the D.C. Court of Appeals, former Solicitor General, former independent counsel, Dean of Pepperdine Law School, President of Baylor. We could go on and on. But unfortunately, I know the man, and there's another side, and it starts, and I want to share just a couple of stories about that man and what he taught his deputies and his assistant independent counsels during the Whitewater investigation, which ran from approximately 1994 through 2001. And that was gather the facts, be good custodians of the facts, exercise sound judgment, and follow the evidence where it goes. And as Alice Starr, his wife who's present and up here at one of the front tables, would say throughout the investigation to us when we would gather at their house from time to time to have some camaraderie, just do the right thing. So we're here with Ken today, and I'm delighted to be here to share this because so much of this has never seen the light of day. For example, the trip to the White House in the middle of the night to take a blood sample from President Clinton. It's kind of unique, and 18 years of prosecution as a state and federal prosecutor, I never had that opportunity. So the format for today is the fireside chat. And after about 15 minutes, we get through some questions that you'll want to hear put and answered by Ken. Then it will be your turn to ask some questions, and I plan to try to ask yours. I'll repeat yours if we can't hear. We're going to have some people run the mic out to you. I may repeat them if they're not. If we can't all hear them. And then we'll continue on with the Q&A with Ken that I've developed through this format. So thank you for being here. I sincerely appreciate it. And you're about to learn some interesting information. Thank you. Okay, so Ken, here we are. We've been planning this for a while.
It's good to be with you, Ed.
So let's start with this book you've been working on, Contempt, a memoir of the Clinton investigation. When did you start this book, and where did the idea come from?
After the election. Yeah, after the election of 2016, I had been thrown off the bus, so to speak, at Baylor, which we still love. We still live in Waco. We maintain a home in Northern Virginia. And so step one was I wrote, Ed, a book about Baylor University. I love Baylor, telling the story, but also talking about the unpleasantness, issues of governance, and so forth. And in the meantime, as I was still working on that book, I was being encouraged, given my newfound circumstances and freedom, and I wasn't rushing back to law practice, I am practicing law now, to do this book. As Alice notes, the 20th anniversary was coming up, so that seemed timely and appropriate. So the circumstances were such that I just had the sense that it's now or never. I need to tell the story from the perspective of a memoir. And one thing I just want to say at the outset, Ed, about the book, and thank you for arranging all this, and I should have said also, but he posed the question. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for your hospitality for all of the chapters. There's some students here, but for lawyers throughout the state. And Jason, again, thank you, and the leadership of others. I also just want to say about the Federalist Society, I was present almost at the creation. I was not one of the creators, but I was present at almost the creation. Certainly, I was present at the very first conference held in the early 1980s, and Leonard was not even in law school at that time. So that just shows that the Federalist Society has not only grown, but it's matured, but it's maintained its fidelity to the principle that there should be a debate, there should be a conversation, a discussion. And so I continue to applaud. I'm a member, proudly, Alice and I are, of the James Madison Club. So when you're thinking about that year in giving or the beginning of year ending, so I'm sorry, let me not turn this into a commercial. So thank you again for everyone being here. I need to say one other thing. In the conversation that we're about to have, even though facts are flinty things, and this is what our stock in trade, right? We have a legal framework, but it is the facts. The facts drive the issues at hand, and then we reflect on the principles of law, the statutes, the jurisprudence, and so forth. What I'd like this conversation to be is one that I'm going to try to be looking through the lens consistent with the values of the Federalist Society through the precept, or through the lens, I should say, of our constitutional structure. And I so appreciate it. Do you appreciate the governor's comments last night in talking about the structure of government that that no lesser light than Mr. Madison, but among many of that founding generation, viewed, and the term parchment barriers was used in the conversation, the Attorney General of your state, the Governor of your state, speaking through the voice of this understanding of the way we began the constitutional experiment, which is, it is the structural edifice of separation of powers. And then Hamilton's Federalist 78, the Hamilton, the musical, 78, in terms of the role of the judicial branch, and I know you're very thankful for what the governor has done in terms of the restoration of a vision of judges who don't fashion themselves as philosopher kings and queens, right? But who've had the sense of fidelity to the law and the idea of governed by we the people. So separation of powers and federalism. But obviously when we're talking, Ed, as you well know, having experienced as you did two independent councils, we're really talking about separation of powers in the independent council experiment. The last thing I want to say in this overlong introduction already is that the term, which is harsh, contempt, emerged out of my meditation on the facts. And as I kept reading and rereading Chief Judge Susan Weber Wright's opinion holding President Clinton in contempt. So this is not a pejorative diatribe. This is a fact. John Adams, facts are flint to the Boston jury in defending those young men charged as they were with pretty serious offenses, right? Firing into the crowd in Boston. And so this young lawyer says to the jury, facts are flinty things. And he was pretty successful. A couple got acquitted, and some charges were dismissed, et cetera, thanks to John Adams's remarkable lawyering for the sake of the liberty. But in any event, as I'm reading Chief Judge Susan Weber Wright's opinion, holding the President of the United States in contempt, there it was. And by the way, he was held in contempt, my dear friends, read her opinion, for obstruction of justice. That sounds sort of familiar, doesn't it? Said, well, this is so unlike Watergate Oh, really? Have you read Chief Judge? Don't read my report, our report. Read Chief Judge Susan Weber Wright's opinion. And by the way, you say, well, judges will hold almost anything. They didn't appeal. The only thing that was done after Chief Judge Susan Weber Wright, very respected judge, holds the President of the United States in contempt, the first and only time, happily, in American history that that has happened, David Kendall, the very able lawyer, issued a press release saying, we believe this was inappropriate, the sanction. But we call it notice of appeal, right? Motion for reconsideration. Neither of those is filed.
So Judge Wright's opinion was April 12th, 1999, and you waited nearly 19 or 20 years to write about this.
I'm a very slow writer.
But I've read the book, and I notice you're a very excellent writer. So tell us what happened, what festered for 20 years before you put pen to paper.
Well, there's something to be said about not rushing, which seems to be the fashion of the day. We were talking about that at the, well, I've left the White House. It's time to sign a contract with an agent and write my book. I welcome to a free country. The Federalist Society would say, let freedom ring. We believe in freedom of speech and the freedom to write, et cetera. But for one thing, I'm very thankful that this time has gone by so that I could reflect about the seriousness of the entire enterprise, as well as before I depart the scene entirely, so to speak, to sort of set the record from my perspective straight, such as there are 14 criminal convictions, including the sitting governor of the state. And so there's this sense that nothing happened until Monica Lewinsky walked into our professional lives through Linda Tripp. But absolutely untrue. The other thing I felt that we needed to say, what did I say? Oh, Alice is sending me signals. I said something very bad. What did I say bad?
Okay. I have a question, though.
Oh, yeah, well, that was deliberate. Lawyers try to choose their words carefully. I don't often succeed. Yes, sir.
When Alice looks that way, she means to me, ask a question, Ed.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that he's giving a speech.
Okay. So how is this Judge Susan Weber Wright's order from 1999, how does it affect the title of your book? Is that the connection?
That's the connection. She found him in contempt. She held him in contempt of court for his obstruction of justice.
And help us understand, how long did it take you to write this book?
Oh, not that terribly long. When did I begin writing, Alice? I would say 6 months.
And you viewed yourself as the custodian of facts, I've heard and read.
I don't like that word, custodian. Yeah, I wanted it to be factual. I'm getting set up here. This guy's he's a very good lawyer, so. And I thought is this direct or is this cross?
We're getting to cross.
Oh, we're getting to cross, yeah. Where is my lawyer? I thought this is my lawyer.
He's here. Jason's there.
But Jason, come bail me out, I can tell.
He doesn't stand up till later.
I'm being led down a path. It seems to be called Primrose Path.
Well, what I recall is you phoned around to some of your deputies and other staff trying to revive some memories.
Oh, he's leading the witness, but the witness refuses to be led. The witness is being dense. Yes, I called around to some of my colleagues. Yes, because I definitely needed help, assistance in various and sundry ways. Because obviously we were a group of people. I was not a solo practitioner by any means. And moreover, one of the things I describe in the book is, you know, and by the way, I call Ed Page Mr. Ambassador, because he carried on some of the most sensitive duties in terms of relationships and just had such credibility and broad credibility to the investigation from his service, which was ongoing in the United States Attorney's office in Tampa, where he was, of course, and still is, a renowned trial lawyer. But he brought all that in. So, Mr. Ambassador, I would just say I called you, because some of my colleagues had very important experiences that I needed refreshing about. So, yes, it's my memoir, but I definitely got help. And every now and then, you know, I would actually go look at some other books and so forth. But I decided I wanted this to be my memoir, my best recollection of what had happened.
My next question is, when I watch television and listen to various commentators, I hear them remark that Whitewater investigation and the others that followed it produced no criminal convictions. Why did they say that?
Well, it's honestly, I think laziness. I don't think it's outright mendacity, but people who have microphones, here we are, who just don't take the time to do the hard work of understanding these are really the facts. And there's frankly no excuse for that. I mean, it's a lack of professionalism. But especially when you think that the convictions, after a very hard-fought three-month jury trial in Little Rock, resulted in the convictions of a sitting governor, as I mentioned, of James and Susan McDougal, and who were they so long ago? Well, Jim and Susan were Bill and Hillary's partners. Now, they were partners with crooks. You say, well, that's an unkind thing to say. Well, they were convicted of serious felonies, fraud that led to the collapse of Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan, which Jim and Susan, they were the sole owners. They ran the place. And the trial was not only hard fought, everyone was extremely well represented, but there was a jury in the box that, and we had a very young jury consultant who has gone on to some considerable success, and I've worked with him recently, but he was sort of starting out at that time, and he was Ray and Leroy Yon's student at St. Mary's Law School in San Antonio. And he said, you know, we've done the best we can, but this will be viewed as a defense, a pro-defense jury. You know, the jury, the trial people here, you know what I'm talking about. And now we have so many judges here. This was an example, Ed, as you know, you were otherwise engaged in another very important investigation of Secretary Henry Cisneros. And that resulted in some very important guilty pleas as well. What happened was the stature of the judge, and I talk about this a good deal in the book, who was himself a victim of the segregated South, and he was educated in the basement, his legal education, of the University of Arkansas Law School because of the pigment of his skin. That great man, now deceased, George Howard Jr., appointed by President Carter, was a paragon of virtue. And I'll always remember this. We would get frustrated because we would object, and the judge would be inclined to say, now, Mr. Yon, our lead prosecutor, is the winner of the great trial prize from the Department of Justice because of his service, distinguished service as a trial attorney. Now, Mr. Yon, liberty is at stake, and so I'm going to allow the defense a little leeway. Well, we learned, stop making the objection, because, and we would kind of say, the judge is going to allow the defense a little leeway. But he would also, because the Arkansas Democrat Gazette was filled, this is first page, front page story, you know, 6 days out of the week, Judge Howard would draw figuratively with his fingers, looking at the jury, multiracial, biracial jury dominated by women, and he would say, now, it is very important, and he would remind them of this, the trial judges know you have to remind the jurors, do not listen to anyone, including your family members, and please don't be reading the press or watching the news and so forth. You are to take only the evidence that is adduced within, and then he would draw the four corners of this courtroom. And he had this beautiful way of communicating. It was almost pastoral, but he ended up having such moral force that you could just see the dynamic with the jury. We're going to do the right thing, was this message being sent by the jury. And of course they did. They did have a couple of accounts were acquittals, so that's good that the jury was doing it too. Now, a 3-month hard-fought trial during a presidential election year of the president and the first lady's business partners and Hillary's client. That tells you this had perhaps some significance, but I think politically, I'll leave that to others to, because we were not in politics, we were simply there, find out the facts, assess the facts, and bring the appropriate charges before the grand jury if we felt that the charges could be sustained and so forth, consistent with DOJ policy. So this is all part of the narration of the book, and those years of reflection caused me, frankly, to admire the judge even more. And the important role of the judge as a symbol of moral authority, obviously, is the custodian of the law. The jury's the custodian of the facts to make the credibility assessments and so forth. But one thing this book does, it's a real tribute to the judges.
Let's talk about how you became to be appointed independent counsel back in 1994. Help us understand. There was someone before you, and then you were appointed and served for a number of years, correct?
Right.
All right. So who was before you, and how did it work that we needed another and new independent counsel in 1994?
Right. Query whether. And now we move back to separation of powers. I was appointed by a 3-judge panel of Judge Katz's current court, called the Special Division of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. And 3 appellate judges from around the country designated by the Chief Justice of the United States for 2-year terms which were renewable. So I was appointed by the judiciary, which was one, but only one, of the points that Justice Antonin Scalia had lifted up and focused on in his magnificent, I see a lot of heads already shaking, Morrison versus Olson. We missed Justice Scalia's voice. It continues to live on, and we're thankful for that. But I heard, and I viewed him as a friend. I was privileged to serve on the D.C. Circuit at that time, again, Judge Katz's court. Alice and I still, well, Nino would say this or Nino would say that, so forgive me, I mean no disrespect to his very great and precious memory, but Nino would say this was his finest opinion, and note that it was a solitary dissent, 7-1, upholding the independent counsel provisions, constitutionality in the face of, I think, extremely serious and grave constitutional issues, including the appointment of authority, which was taken away from the executive branch, Article 2, and placed in the Article 3 branch. So there was an anomaly, not unknown to our history. Judges have appointed in the federal system prosecutors, et cetera. I understand that. But it was unusual. So I was appointed in 1994 when the independent counsel provisions of the Independent Counsel of the Ethics and Government Act were revived. They had sunsetted. Congress had, shall I say, less than robust self-confidence in this institution, which was a post-Watergate reform. And so I then replaced the, quote, administrative independent counsel, what we'd now call a special counsel. So my predecessor was Robert Fisk, very distinguished lawyer with whom I had worked in the past on private practice matters, and a great, great man. So he was appointed by Janet Reno, Floridian, who's deceased now, district attorney in Dade County, as you know. And Attorney General Reno appointed her at the direction of the President of the United States. Bill Clinton said, feeling the heat from media reports and so forth, okay, we're going to have to take this investigation into the collapse of Madison Guaranty Savings and Loan and the funding of the Whitewater Real Estate Development Project, take it out of the Justice Department and put it into from the line Justice Department and into a, quote, special counsel. Quick historical note, I note this in the book. This is deeply rooted in our history and tradition, this being the Attorney General or the President himself saying, we need to bring someone from outside the Department of Justice to investigate our administration or me or someone in high office. And the first president to do that was Ulysses S. Grant. Archibald Cox of Watergate fame was appointed pursuant to this, what I call it, the Grant, the Ulysses S. Grant model. You simply go outside the department. Ulysses S. Grant says, okay, I'm the GOP, the party of Lincoln. I'm going to, in light of the allegations, and he did it himself. He appointed a Democrat from a former United States senator from Missouri to investigate the so-called whiskey ring. So that's the way it all began. We don't need to go into the details. That was the structural move. But notice that was an exercise of executive authority, executive discretion, and so forth. And that was our history. Teapot Dome was an exception, including through Watergate, until the creation of this 21, as it turned out to be, 21-year experiment called the Independent Counsel Provisions. We've now gone away from that. The Iran-Contra, the Reagan, Oliver North, the Republicans hated that investigation. Whitewater, especially Lewinsky, impeachment. The Democrats hated that, and so everyone sort of beat their swords into plowshares, and we returned to the Grant model, which is exactly the way Bob Mueller was appointed.
So that's an entirely new set of rules and regulations, different from the Independent Counsel statute from 1978.
And I believe, yes, it is, and I believe it has resolved what to me was one, but by no means the only, constitutional defect in the Independent Counsel apparatus. Now, the Supreme Court upheld it, an opinion by Chief Justice Rehnquist. It was a 7-1 opinion, so super majority. But I thought that that opinion at the time was extraordinarily weak. I should add that Judge Cassis's court, speaking through the voice of Judge Silberman, who's still serving on that court with great distinction, had authored an opinion striking down the independent counsel provisions as unconstitutional.
So where do you fall on the debate between the independent counsel statute and the new regulation that resulted in Mueller's appointment as special counsel?
Yeah, I would have been, I recused myself from participating for reasons that we don't need to go on in the D.C. Circuit. But I was convinced that, in fact, on two occasions, we testified in the Justice Department through Rudy Giuliani, of all people, that we believed, I'm talking about we being the Reagan administration, Justice Department, we believed that the independent counsel provisions were unconstitutional as a violation of separation of powers. And I fall on that. So had I been on the D.C. Circuit, I mean, I was on the D.C. Circuit, but had I been voting, I would have voted with Judge Silberman. Now, that having been said, the Supreme Court upheld it, and so years go by, and I'm asked to serve. You ask, how was I appointed? I was appointed by my former colleagues who reached out to me. I definitely didn't apply. Some people applied. I definitely did not apply for that particular job.
Did you seek it out?
Did I seek it? No, I didn't apply, nor did I seek, but I also didn't issue a William Tecumseh Sherman-like statement.
Did you volunteer?
No.
So you took good counsel from others who said, be careful for those kind of opportunities.
You know, I think Alice and I full well recognize that this was not a great job.
Always the master of understatement. So you get appointed, you start building your office from some of the remnants, if we may, from Bob Fisk's office. You keep some and hire others, correct?
I tried to keep everyone.
All right.
But there was a lot of consternation, understandably so, on the part of Bob Fisk's staff. They were very angry at the special division because Janet Reno did want Bob to be appointed under the statute.
Okay. But why was, and if you know, the special division reluctant to reappoint Fisk under the now revived independent counsel statute?
Yes. In fact, the order, so let's go to the text. The order appointing yours truly made it clear that the special division was of the view that Bob Fisk, having been appointed by the Attorney General, lacked the structural, formal independence from the administration, and therefore they, the special division, needed to go outside the ambit of an Attorney General decision and to bring somebody fresh in.
So you start hiring and building an office. What's your model or design, if you will, for the office?
To create a microcosm of the Justice Department consistent with checks and balances within, including a very elaborate indictment review. I was privileged to serve as Chief of Staff to the Attorney General. So while I had never served as a prosecutor, I'd never served in the criminal division in a policy capacity, I knew the procedures. And so, as you will recall, we had a very elaborate indictment review process. I also wanted to recreate a microcosm of the Justice Department in terms of bringing great assistant United States attorneys who had renowned records of integrity and accomplishment into the office, and to build this microcosm, as I say, of the Justice Department.
Now, in the application that I filled out in 1998, after more unpleasantness had arrived at the office through Linda Tripp, there was no box for checking Democrat or Republican. Did you employ both?
I think so.
Yes.
But no, I never asked. It was utterly irrelevant, and I mean utterly irrelevant, because this was a professional, and everyone who I was hiring or on detail had already taken an oath. Now, we did have some brain trusters in the office who I did recruit, who I'd practiced law with or was recruiting. One, Justice Brett Kavanaugh, who is featured in the book in two different places, and now Secretary of HHS Alex Azar. So I was very blessed to have some incredibly great people around me or on the way into my then law firm at Kirkland and Ellis, and that's the kind of folks I wanted, as because I knew it was going to be a very tenacious, and it was, struggle with the White House from time to time in terms of issues such as executive privilege and the like.
And, of course, you had behind the scenes Alice, your wife, who we may refer to as your co-star, correct?
Oh, how sweet. And during Valentine's Day month as well.
Just getting ready, Alice. You know. So tell us about this character, Kavanaugh. Where'd you find him?
Well, I was recruiting then Brett Kavanaugh, who was completing the Justice Kennedy clerkship, but he had actually been in the Solicitor General's office, where I was privileged to serve for a season, as a so-called Bristow Fellow, serving for a year. And he was doing that in between clerkships. He had clerked for, sorry to go into detail, it was a very interesting story, Walter Stapleton on the Third Circuit, a wonderful man, great judge. And then he was on his way out to clerk for Judge Alex Kaczynski. And so he spent that year, just shows his dedication to public service. And with us as a Bristow Fellow, we had four Bristow Fellows at that time, so Brett was one of them. I had limited but nonetheless pleasant dealings with him. He then goes, clerks for Alex, who I co-clerked with for Chief Justice Berger a long time ago. Then Alex is a real feeder to Justice Kennedy, and so Brett then goes to Justice Kennedy. I then started the recruiting process at the appropriate time. By this time, I was at Kirkland. So he agrees to come to Kirkland. Then I get appointed as independent counsel. So we ate at Cactus Cantina. Let the record show, we both had iced tea. I've reconstructed this. Neither one of us had cerveza. It was lunch, after all. So the sun was not past the yard arm. And so I said, Brett, you know, you see what's happened, and I have a feeling this is going to be very intellectually challenging, not just whatever happens, fact development and so forth. So how about, I think I can wrap it up in 6 months. How about working with me for 6 months? Isn't there a song, Fools Rush In? but angels were not treading there. And he said, okay. So that's how it began. And that he stayed for a couple of years, leaves, goes back to the firm. Then when Linda Tripp comes in, introducing us, so to speak, to Monica Lewinsky, Brett was very brave because he knew it was not career enhancing. But he came back to the independent counsel's office with the blessing of the firm, to which I'm still very grateful.
You mentioned a moment ago this phrase, brain trusters. So help us understand what you mean by brain trusters, and then another, I think, category of people you staffed the office with.
Gladiators, you know. I wanted my great trial lawyers, and so you're an example of that, of those who are great, well-rounded lawyers, but they haven't necessarily spent 2 or 3 years clerking. The sort of intellectual side, especially of some what I knew would be some tough issues, as I said before, and sure enough, an example of what the brain trust did. So these are basically Supreme Court law clerks.
So in other words, you would send the bulldog to go get the president's blood, not a brain truster.
Yeah, I didn't think... Yeah.
No further questions.
Yeah. Okay. In fact, I think no Supreme Court law clerks were in the room when that happened.
Wonder why that was.
Well, we all have talents. I love the parable of the talents in the New Testament.
Tell us about that.
But we all have gifts. Well, it is Saturday, shall we go into Sunday school mode? So anyway, use your talents, use your gifts, but also, and I think schools, by the way, to make an education point, are very intentional. There are a lot of things that education institutions need to do much better, and we've got a reform, a senior official to a great reform governor of Florida here, Governor Jeb Bush, who works so hard on education issues. One of the things education institutions are doing better these days is helping students identify their gifts. What is it that you're good at? So it was really as simple as that, but I knew, and this was a real blessing, that we had people of the capability of a Brett Kavanaugh and others to do the really heavy lifting in terms of the briefing that we had going on in camera, both in the district court and the Court of Appeals, especially on issues such as, and I want to get this out, the so-called protective function privilege, which was an extraordinarily creative but groundless claim by President Clinton, first through the Treasury Department, that Secret Service agents could not testify, interposing the protective function privilege as a reason. We had to litigate that all the way up to the Supreme Court.
But what about this principle called the rule of law?
Yeah. What happened to that principle? In fact, it's one of the things that I think caused the book, frankly, to be appropriately entitled. Because it wasn't just the fact, more is not needed, that the president was found in contempt and held in contempt. But I thought that in various and sundry ways, the president of the United States and the then First Lady showed contempt for the rule of law.
So let's clear up something since we're circling back to that Judge Weber's order of contempt from 1999. Did the Office of Independent Counsel have any stake or weigh in on that, or was that between the lawyers for Paula Jones and someone else?
The latter. We filed nothing. We didn't seek an order of contempt. That was entirely handled in the federal civil rights litigation known as Clinton v. Jones in the Supreme Court of the United States, but Paula Corbin Jones versus William Jefferson Clinton and one of the troopers.
So let's run ahead now to, and I want to have you explain the connection, if you can and will, between Whitewater, Madison Guarantee, and the intervening investigations such as Travelgate or the White House Travel Office firings, Filegate, Web Hubble, et cetera, and how we get to Monica Lewinsky and Linda Tripp in January of 1998, this
right.
5-year intervening period.
And it was a long journey, but I'm going to be extremely brief on this. We had add-ons. Attorney General Reno would go to the Special Division and say, Travel Office, we need that investigation. FBI files, as you mentioned. Then I had inherited not simply the Whitewater investigation, but from Bob Fisk, the death of Vincent Foster Jr. So let me, and the Billings of Webster Hubble. So there was a multifaceted investigation which I inherited, and that was added onto through the Special Division at the request of the Attorney General. Now,
now oh, did you ahead. Request that, or
no.
did the Attorney General?
The latter.
And unfortunately, that's not a fact that's made apparent in media coverage of the office from that time period. The contrary is, which was, it's pitched as if you were out seeking these additional grants of jurisdiction.
I was trying to go to Pepperdine University to become the dean of the law school, Chad, right?
We noticed with your abrupt resignation.
Which I had to walk back, so I handled that extremely poorly internally, as you know. So now to make the connection all the way, during the investigation of the death of Vincent Foster Jr., which was being broadcast as a murder, it was not, it was a suicide, and Brett Kavanaugh wrote the report. He wasn't doing the forensics. That was being done by very experienced prosecutors, FBI agents. We brought in experts and so forth to write the definitive word, but he wrote the words. Justice Kavanaugh is a very, very gifted writer. So anyway, he did that report. If one reads the report, one will read that the last person in the White House complex to see Vincent Foster Jr. alive was Linda Tripp, who was serving as the executive assistant to Vincent Foster Jr., the deputy White House counsel. So when Linda called on that fateful night in January of 1998, she said to our colleague Jack Bennett, you know me. Is that me?
That's almost you.
Oh, these clients, they call at the most inopportune times.
This, unfortunately, is my reminder to...
Oh, sorry.
You and I are getting short.
Okay, very good. So everyone looks very relieved. So you you know me, says Linda Tripp. I'm Linda Tripp. I was, and Jackie needed to be reminded of this because he was not involved in that Washington phase.
Jackie, non-brain truster Bennett.
He's so sensitive. Great trial lawyer who likewise, like Ray Yon, won this very coveted award as the leading trial lawyer during every year. A single trial lawyer, and I mean trial lawyer, in the Department of Justice, both United States Attorney's Offices and the Litigation Division, is anointed, is dubbed as the leading trial lawyer of that year for some major accomplishment. And Jack, by the way, was on that original team. He was on detail to us from the public integrity section of the criminal division of the Justice Department, and that's quite a mouthful. So Jackie takes the call, is talking to Linda Tripp, and there was the factual connection because she had been a very credible witness. And now what she's saying, she is saying, I'm being asked to commit perjury. This young woman, Monica Lewinsky, has already filed a perjurious affidavit. I'm being asked to commit perjury. And we were already of the view that Bill Clinton had committed perjury throughout the Whitewater phase of the investigation, that Hillary had committed perjury. All this I lay out in the book.
Can you tell us a little bit more about the protective function privilege and how that evaporated under scrutiny and what happened yeah. next?
Well, it was simply a delay, stalling tactic that out of thin air, I'll use another metaphor, invented out of whole cloth is the notion of the protective function privilege. And that was interposed to prevent Secret Service agents when the president denied everything in terms of the relationship, et cetera, never encouraged anyone to lie, et cetera, wrong. So we began methodically gathering the evidence, and so for months on end, we were prevented from interviewing, much less putting them before the grand jury, Secret Service agents, because of this phantom non-existent privilege. So we first won before Norma Holloway Johnson, then we won before a unanimous, and all this was in camera, by the way, so this was not out in the public domain. And then the D.C. Circuit unanimously upholds Judge Johnson. There is no such privilege. But it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court just denied cert.
And caused, through that litigation, approximately 6 or 7 month delay in the fact finding.
Certainly, multi-months. I won't say 6 or 7 months, but it certainly was more than 3, probably more than 4.
The investigation after that started to speed up, did it not, when the Secret Service was allowed to testify about their observations within the Oval Office and, remember this name, Bayani Nelvis's workroom off of the Oval Office? Yes?
Yes. You just reminded me.
It only took an hour to train you as a witness.
he didn't make it into the book. But I do want to say about this, that the real obstacle created by the president's mendacity was Monica Lewinsky. And I go into some detail in the book about Monica's steely determination not to hurt the president. And finally, she got very able defense lawyers in Washington, and within a matter of a few weeks, we had a deal. We wanted to have a deal. We wanted her honest, truthful testimony, and we eventually got that testimony with her extraordinary, and I mean it was an extraordinary memory of very specific, and I'm not talking about the salacious part, very specific dimensions of the relationship, which is a very complex and poignant relationship.
Criticism has been voiced for the detail and specificity in the Starr report regarding, we're supposed to stop for good then. We're going to go on because we're lawyers and we've asked for another 5, correct?
Okay. Thank you.
Criticism, and it's been very acute and vocal, has been voiced about the specificity over and over again of the Starr report. Why was it so specific about various allegations and the factual detail supporting impeachment or supporting what happened, I should say?
A very simple reason: we had to prove our case. We had 11 counts in the impeachment referral. And so if you're going to accuse the President of the United States of perjury, obstruction of justice, and the like, you better prove your case. Now, I had two very wonderful brain trusters come to me, Brett Kavanaugh and Professor Bill Kelly of the Notre Dame Law School. And they said, Ken, Judge, whatever your name is, Uncle Ken, you really shouldn't do this. This is going to be really bad. And I listened to them, but I was persuaded by my career prosecutors. And the career prosecutors, to a person, said, we've got to prove it. And the only way to prove it is, here it is. Here's the evidence. We didn't create the facts, but here are the facts. And happily, by virtue of the elaborate nature of the detail, to this day, there's been no serious contesting of the facts. Now, should that have resulted in articles of impeachment and so forth, then we move into the political arena, rightly entrusted to the House and to the Senate. Before we adjourn, I do have to say this. One of the criticisms of the statute itself, articulated by Justice Scalia, was the very fact of this report, the 595C report in the statute, requiring any independent counsel to refer to the House of Representatives when substantial and credible information came to us that an impeachable offense, left undefined, may have been committed. Now, in his dissenting opinion, Justice Scalia, long before what happened in 1998, 10 years before, said this statute is acrid with the smell of impeachment. The regulations now extant, under which Bob Mueller was appointed, has been appointed, is silent, happily. The I word is never used. Moreover, the word confidential is used in those. So when everybody says, well, the Mueller report, is it going to read like War and Peace, or is it going to be like The Great Gatsby or something in between, and so forth? If one simply takes and go to Bill Barr's confirmation hearings, a wonderful nominee of the president, under whom I served, with whom I served, and then under whom I served as Justice Department under President Bush 41, you will see that the report may be very minimalist. The Attorney General's report. So under the regulations, as you know, and Bob Mueller reports, provides a confidential report to the Attorney General, and then the Attorney General reports to Congress. So remains to be seen.
So no special report from Mueller goes to the House?
That's correct. It will be a report from the attorney. At least that's what the regulations contemplate. Right. Now, obviously, the Attorney General will have his discretion in interpreting these regulations, and so it'll ultimately be the judgment of Bill Barr.
Right. We're going to wrap up here shortly. We wanted to take a few questions from the audience, and we have some people to run microphones around. If anybody has any, I'm happy to entertain those. Yes, sir.
Jordan Lawrence with Alliance Defending Freedom. I have a question about the Bladensburg Cross case. Excuse me, that First Liberty is helping to represent them, and it's going to be up on February 27th. And I'm thinking of two things. You work with John Roberts and with Brett Kavanaugh, and then you argued Levy Weissman, where they were attempting to do the same thing, and now it looks like the ring of power is finally going to get thrown into Mount Doom, maybe, and just what your thoughts about it and maybe being vindicated after all these years.
We should win that. I'm sorry, we should win it 7-2. I hope we bring Steve Breyer and Elena Kagan on to say, please, the tradition and so forth, the tradition, the long-settled nature of it, the lack of coercion, the kind of values that inform freedom of conscience that we heard so eloquently expressed today are simply not at stake, are not injured by this. And also just, I've not read the briefs, by the way, so I'm very under-informed at this stage. Justice Breyer went to such lengths in Van Orden to separate out the Texas monument of the Ten Commandments versus the Kentucky case involving the recent display. So history and tradition has historically counted for a lot. E.G., the Supreme Court's decision in Marsh v. Chambers upholding the constitutionality of a paid chaplaincy in the state of Nebraska and its unicameral legislature. And the court not only did not apply the so-called three-part Lemon v. Kurtzman test, didn't even mention it, and simply said history and tradition are triumphant. Justice Brennan's dissenting opinion says you're just relying on history and tradition, and that's what a slender majority did then. But I think Justice Breyer seems to be comfortable with that, unless he's had an epiphany, as it were, to lead him to a much more I shouldn't use a pejorative term, separationist view. But I think it's going to be hard for an opinion to be written that would not have terrible implications for Arlington National Cemetery and so forth. So, but we'll see what Ruth and Sonia do.
Any other questions? Why don't we...
Thank you for raising something other than this infernal independent council statue.
So, Ken, let's wrap up, though, with what are a couple takeaways from your experience there? What are some lessons going forward for us as Federalists, as lawyers, and with the evolution of the independent council statute now into the special council statute?
I think the biggest, there are many, but the biggest takeaway is that the founding generation, here we are at the Federalist Society together, knew what it was doing. In saying that we're dividing powers in order to preserve liberty. And so there was this odd amalgamation and creation of this hybrid officer called the Independent Council, and there has been now a restoration under the Reno regulations in which Bob Mueller was appointed so that there is greater accountability and yet an assurance of day-to-day independence. But I like the regulations very, very much in saying that I think the term major is used, but I'm not sure, excuse me for being uncertain about that. But the regulations contemplate, for example, I would tend to think before the raid was done to the arrest in Fort Lauderdale of Roger Stone, I thought it was high-handed. I thought it was absolutely unnecessary, but then again, I don't know. But I think that under the regulations, I would say that either Rod Rosenstein or Matt Whitaker or both approve that. So the point is, you may like it or you may not like it, but the point is there's accountability within the political branches, and that, I think, is exactly what the founding generation wanted, in which we continue to lift up as the Federalist Society is part of the real bastion barricade of American freedom.
Thank you, and you'll be signing books after we finish.
Yes, I do want to introduce my dear friend Leland McKee. Leland, would you stand up? And Sophia, can you sing for us? But we're going to sing Happy Birthday in advance, so she left. So Sophia turns, how old does she turn? 12, and she's a very talented singer. May we sing Happy Birthday?
Absolutely.
Will that be all right, Leland? Okay, that's all right. We're going to sing it to her anyway. Alice, lead us.
Happy birthday to
Sophia.
You.
Sophia.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Sophia.
Wherever you are.
Happy birthday to you. Thank you.